Let's have a big hand for Ilja von Sprandl.
Awesome. Okay. So as previously mentioned, my title is Are All BSDs Created Equally? A Survey of BSD Kernel Vulnerabilities. Start off with, who am I? My name is Ilja von Sprandl. I work for a company called IOActive. I did spend the last 5 years in America, but I recently moved back to Belgium a couple of weeks ago. I'm a computer security consultant. I do pen tests, code review. I break stuff when I'm profit. I've been going to the CCC Congress since 1993, which has been a while, and I've spoken a couple times before. I think this will be my 7th or 8th time. And let's see how this goes. Right, so my presentation is sort of split into 3-4-ish pieces. There's an intro, which will be the next slide, and then there's a little bit of data that I'll show, and then there's lack of data, so I want to test a couple of things, and then once I've tested that and I've gathered some results, I'll present my results and my conclusions. Right, so what is this talk about, BSD kernel vulnerabilities? It's a comparison between the different current BSD flavors. As for what I expect from the audience, if you basically I expect some basic Unix kernel-ish knowledge, not too deep, but some would be nice. People that I think might appreciate this talk are, you know, if you're a low-level security enthusiast, if you're a USD or BSD geek, and then if you're a Linux guy, you might like this too. And then generally people that are curious about OS internal security, I think might enjoy this presentation. Before I move on, I have to mention, you know, some people that I call this standing on the shoulders of giants because you don't do this by yourself. You build upon work by others. So there's a number of people that have done interesting BSD kernel security research over the last, I don't know, decade and a half, maybe 2 decades. Some of them might even be at the Congress. Silvio Noir, a bunch of others that did some really interesting work. This presentation sort of started with a post to a mailing list years and years ago by Thio Durant, who, if you don't know who he is the main guy behind OpenBSD. And I remember reading this 12 years ago, and it's been sort of stuck in my head since then. And it's basically a quote from Thio where he goes, you know, if the Linux people actually cared about quality, you know, as the OpenBSD people do, they would not have had as many local root security holes as they had last year, which is that year, which is 2005. And Thio goes, how many is it? Like 20 or so. And so I think that was, you know, when he makes that sort of said, oh, 20 or so. I was like, really, you know, is that true? What's the data behind that? Can we look at some of this? And so I basically started looking at the last almost 20 years of Linux kernel vulnerabilities and what the numbers are. And so I went to CVE details, and they basically keep a record of this stuff. And it goes back to 1999. And if you look at it, you know, the first 3 or 4 years, it's, you know, in the teens. And then starting 2004, 2005, it sort of jumps up, goes up into the hundreds. And then this table is from July of this year, so the 2017 numbers aren't correct. And so in July 2017, it was 346 Linux kernel vulnerabilities, but as of today, because I checked earlier, it was 434 Linux kernel vulnerabilities. And so as you see, these numbers are kind of sort of growing. CVE details doesn't have the same numbers for like BSD kernel issues. They have like general BSD numbers, but that's all encompassing the OS. And I wanted the specific BSD kernel numbers. And so what I did is I sort of scraped the FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD numbers and sort of put them into a nice little table. And if you look at the tables here for the BSDs, you'll see that the first couple of years they're kind of on par with Linux, but then the Linux ones kind of explode, but the BSD ones will sort of more or less stay the same, either single digits or low teens. It doesn't really go over 17, and that was only OpenBSD a year ago. So if you look at these numbers, Thio's observation was pretty astute observation. In fact, 20 was a low estimate. It turns out it was significantly more. And so you see that numbers for BSD and Linux over the years are not the same or not on the same level. And so what I asked is, are they on equal footing? Like, obviously, there's a really large community behind the Linux kernel. If you look at the BSDs, it's, you know, it's a small group of developers, a small group of users that are using these things and compiling them themselves and so forth. And so I wonder if that is, if that's the reason, or if there is a reason why the numbers aren't the same, or if it really is, as Theo said, if it's code quality. And obviously, one of the things I consider is, well, maybe it's the many eyeballs thing. And I know there's many eyeballs thing is, you know, very convoluted thing, but there's some truth to that. And so I was wondering if there's some truth to it in this case. Well, and the only way to really do that is to test it, to go and see what the code is really like. Sure enough, there's a guy that did this 15 years ago, Silvio, and he did a Black Hat presentation about this 2003, 14 years ago. Basically, he did an audit of the BSDs and Linux kernel and sort of drew some clues from that. And one of the things that he said was, he said, well, there really isn't much difference between the Linux kernel and the BSD kernels in terms of security auditing. They're equally-ish broken. It's easy enough to find bugs in both of them, and the same kind of bugs. Now, that was 15 years ago. Have things changed since then? The other thing he said was that you only spend a couple days on BSDs and then 3 months on Linux. If you had spent longer on the BSDs, would you have gotten more bugs, or would you sort of hit a limit, right? And then the third one is sort of the, if you look at his presentation, and this is 15 years ago, he mostly looked for, or mostly found trivial integer overflows and info leaks and nothing else. And so the other thing I had is, what if I expand the number of bugs I look for? What if I also look for, you know, race conditions and things like that? The data is interesting, but it's kind of a little bit outdated and a bit too limited. At the time, I think it was perfect. For today's purposes, it's not quite good enough. So the only way to really figure out if those numbers line up or don't line up, what the reason behind it is I had to dig in myself. And so I spent April, May, June, and July of this year looking at BSD kernel code. I don't know exactly how much time I spend on each one of them, but I would say they're more or less equal. Basically what I did is I asked myself, if I was going to look for bugs, where would the bugs be? Where do I think they would make mistakes? So I made a list of sort of attack surfaces that I wanted to go look at. And none of these are, I think, overly surprising. Obviously, the common stuff is like, yeah, obviously, I'm going to take a look at some syscalls, and I'll take a look at the TCP/IP stack. And then, yeah, I'll take a look at some drivers, and I'll look at the compat code and the trap handlers and the file systems and, you know, other networking stuff. I essentially spend 3-ish months looking at that. What I want to do is I want to jump over some of the things that in each of those areas that I found, and then sort of discuss that briefly. And I have a couple of demos in here as well. Then once I've run through that, I'll sort of run you through my results and my conclusions. So let's dive into system calls. Obviously, this is prime attack surface. I don't think it should be any surprise to anybody that, if you're looking for security bugs, the first thing you want to do is look at system calls, because that's the thing where user talks to kernel. The first thing that that you can see or can observe is that among the three big BSDs, there's a difference in the amount of system calls that are implemented. Right? FreeBSD has well over 500, NetBSD has almost 500, and OpenBSD has about 300 and change. So right then and there, there's a clear difference between attack surface between three of them, right? But even sort of regardless of attack surface, my assumption was, given that these are so obvious and so well tested, they're less likely to contain security bugs. And so, I go along and I start looking at system calls and I start playing around with them. And sure enough, this is an OpenB system call, and it's a census log, and you get to give it a number of bytes, and basically that gets passed on eventually to malloc. And the thing about ancient BSD code, OpenB still has this, if you pass an unbound length to malloc, you get an instant kernel panic. And sure enough, that's what happens. If you do syslog and you give it a really long value, the thing blows up. And I actually have a demo of this. I don't know how this is going to work on the screens. Let's see if I can get this to work. Uh, Yeah, okay. Crap, it's not mirroring on my screen, so it's kind of annoying to see this. Hold on, okay. So this is OpenBSD, and this is my little syslog example. And sure enough, boom, that causes a kernel panic. Okay. So yeah, that's the syslog, and that's the kernel panic. There you go. And so what's happening is basically, you know, use the syslog, syscall, and you pass an unbound value, and it causes a panic in malloc. This is OpenBSD 6.1. I haven't looked at the later ones. I know it's been fixed since, but it's been there since OpenBSD 6.0, so it's a fairly recent bug. And here's a second example. This is a system call on FreeBSD called KLDstat, which basically gives you statistics about loaded kernel drivers. And this thing basically has this stat buffer on the stack, fills it out, and then sends it back to user land. But it doesn't fill out everything, and so you get uninitialized bytes in there. This has been, I found it in FreeBSD 11, but it's been in there for just over a decade. Doesn't fully initialize a structure and basically sets it back to user land. And then, hold on, let me see if I can show you a demo of this too. This is KLD leak, and then, oops. And then basically all these bytes are uninitialized kernel memory that's basically flashing over the screen. So that's basically bug number two, where you get to basically leak a whole bunch of uninitialized kernel memory. So basically my previous assumption was wrong, right? When I said that I assumed that because there are system calls and they're so well tested, that it's like less likely to see bugs in them. Well, that turns out to be entirely wrong. You can find bugs in system calls into BSDs within, you know, fairly quickly, fairly easily. Bugs that aren't too esoteric or too weird, fairly straightforward bugs, especially in newly added system calls, but even the older stuff. As you can see, a 10-year-old system call in FreeBSD still had a trivial info leak. So those things do occur. Right, so now that we know there are bugs in system calls and they're fairly easy to find, let's move on to the TCP stack. This one, again, my assumption is it's very well tested and less likely to have bugs because, as we all know, the BSD TCP stack has been around for ages, since the 80s at least, and it's incredibly well tested and highly unlikely to find bugs in there. And for those who don't know what TCP stack is, well, it has things like IPv4 and IPv6 in there, and UDP, TCP, ICMP, IPsec, Ethernet, and things like that. It's been around forever, and so my assumption is unlikely to have bugs in there. So I start looking around, and I find something in OpenBSD TCP stack, which basically parses PPoE packets, and then it's a little bit convoluted, I guess. But basically, the idea is that you take a packet, you start parsing it, and then if it contains the exact right tag and the right error message, basically it does this thing where in the BSDs, the way TCP stack works, they have this thing called mbuffs, and it's buffer management around data that you send in and out. And so there's a whole bunch of APIs around it, right? And the idea is that if you don't use the APIs correctly, things go really wrong. And so in this case, you see this thing called M pulldown. And basically, if M pulldown fails, it will free the mbuff you passed it. And in this case, you'll see, oh, if mbuff fails, there's error code where basically they do go to done. And then in done, they basically free the mbuff, except if the thing failed, the mbuff's already freed. So this is, even though the code's a little bit convoluted to read, it's a relatively easy bug to trigger. It affects OpenBSD 6.1, but it has been there since 2004, so it's been around for over a decade. It turns out when I was looking at this and I found the bug, I checked NetBSD, and it turns out the NetBSD guys had the same bug, but they fixed it, but they never released any kind of advisory for it. And so clearly they never told OpenBSD guys about it. And so they fixed only OpenBSD guys only fixed it when I emailed them about it. And so this bug was, I mean, if you know what you're looking for, this bug was relatively easy to find. And so again, my previous assumption was wrong. Bugs in the GCIP stack do occur with some frequency, in particular newer code, but also it turns out mbuffs are hard, very complicated, and it's error prone. The APIs aren't overly consistent. About half of them, sort of when they fail, they free the mbuff. The other half, when they fail, they don't free the mbuff. Things like that, where it turns out if you have to use mbuffs, it's not quite that easy. You have to really know what you're doing. And there's a number of cases that I found where that doesn't happen. And I'll sort of circle back to mbuff misuse later on when I talk about the Wi-Fi stack. But anyway, TCP stack, turns out, has bugs. Right, so moving on, I looked at some of the drivers, obviously, because it turns out that there's a whole lot of drivers among the BSDs for all sorts of things, really. And given that Unix has a thing where everything is a file, the way you find your drivers is you go to dev, and then in dev it'll have some kind of name, and then you can do file, you open them, and then you can do file operations on that thing, right? So open, read, write, close, and so forth. But obviously, iOctl is the one that you want to look at, because that's generally where most of the interesting attack surface will be. So this is the dev crypto on NetBSD, which has this thing where they, you know, basically have this very, very trivial integer overflow, and then here you get memory corruption. And it's not, this is just one snippet, but if you look at the actual driver, it's like iOctl command, bug, iOctl command, same bug, iOctl command, same bug, 7 or 8 times the same trivial integer overflow shows up. And then, you know, sure enough, you trigger it. So the one I showed was this this iOctl, but there are 7 or 8 others. And then again, let me see if I can demo this. Yeah, that thing's still running. No, I mean, it'll leak kernel memory till the end of time. It won't actually crash because the memory's guaranteed to be there. It's just uninitialized. So this is NetBSD, and then Crypto Overflow, and then boom, sure, the moment I hit this, you get memory corruption. When obviously. yeah, so basically, this is a classic control flow leading to memory corruption. This is definitely exploitable. And then this is a similar driver one. This is FreeBSD. This is a driver called KSIM, which basically gives you access. It shows you kernel symbols for FreeBSD. It's an optional driver you can load. And they have this interesting thing where, you know, they implement the open system call. When they do open, they basically in the driver files, driver file descriptor specific data, they basically take a copy of a pointer that's very specific to your process. And then when you do nmap, they find that pointer and they basically use it. There is an interesting issue here with expired pointers where if I open the device and then I pass that file descriptor along to a different process and I kill the original process and then that other process does an mmap, it's basically using that original pointer to the original process, but the original process is dead, so you have this wild pointer that's being used. This is essentially an expired pointer. And this is very problematic, it turns out. Because you basically, yeah, you're using a wild pointer that can point anywhere to read and write to. I can't really demo this in live because my export kind of sucks and it takes 3 or 4 days to actually hit the bug. I could probably optimize it, I just haven't. And so you'll have to do with a screenshot. But this is essentially what happens if you hit the bug. And then sure enough, if you look at this here, uptime 9 days, 1 hour. So it took 9 days to actually hit the bug. But I did hit it. Right, so that's it for the driver stuff. And there are many, many, many more driver examples, but I figured 2 is enough. Compact code is this thing in the BSDs where basically they allow the OS to sort of emulate a different OS. So if you have a binary that you compile for Linux and you run it on FreeBSD and you turn on a FreeBSD Linux compat emulation layer and you make sure that you have the right shared libraries and stuff installed, then your Linux binary will run perfectly or more or less perfectly on your FreeBSD or NetBSD. And so they have these kind of they have these OS behaviors for different operating systems, and so especially NetBSD has quite a few of them. FreeBSD has less of them, and then OpenBSD pretty much killed most of them. But it's essentially there for either different OSs or older versions of the OS, or you know, you have 64-bit and you're supporting 32-bit versions of the OS. All that stuff goes through the compat layer, and basically that stuff basically has to emulate a whole bunch of system calls. And when you, I found a really nice quote by Tio about the compat layers where he says, well, you know, the people that rely on the compat layers don't care enough to maintain it, and the people who work on mainline systems don't care about compat layers because they don't use them, and the cultures aren't aligned in the same direction. And he basically says, compat layers rot very quickly. And that is absolutely true, and so I'll give an example of this is SVR4 compat code on NetBSD. SVR4 is ancient. Nobody's used that thing probably in 20 years, but it's there and they support it. And this is, they use this thing called streams, which is, it's kind of like sockets, but not. And streams have been dead for a long time, but NetBSD still supports it in SVR4 compat. And they have this thing where basically this function, netadder, sockadder, gets called with this BND pointer, and basically the content of which is defined by userland, and what they do is they basically, you know, grab a value off of it, use it as an offset, and then basically sort of dereference the thing and read data out of it. So this is basically arbitrary, you know, read anything from memory, out of bound read, that obviously can cause a kernel crash or potentially info leak. But the really interesting thing about this code is if you scroll all the way up and you look at the comments, it says, yes, this is gross. So they know their code sucks. This code has been around since 1996. So it's been there for 20 years. I mean, there may be people in the room that are younger than this bug. This is really crappy code, and this is what Tia meant when he said compat code rots really quickly. They wrote it 21 years ago. They never looked back. It's there. Probably hasn't been used since 1996, too. So when I told them about it and they fixed it, the log message basically said, well, we fixed a multitude of holes in SVR4 stream code. And then they said, we should have never enabled this by default. And then it's a minefield. And so one of the things I got them to do is when they fixed this thing, they also changed their kernel config, and they turned this shit off by default. Which, you know. Right. So the next thing I looked at are trap handlers. And the thing about trap handlers is that, trap handlers basically do this thing where they handle any kind of sort of exception or fault, which can be division by zero or system call or breakpoint or invalid memory access or a very, very long list of things. And this is essentially mostly this sort of hardware sort of coming to your OS and saying, hey, this kind of fault happened, and you have to deal with it. Some can be triggered by userland, some can only be triggered by hardware, some can only be triggered by kernel. The code to handle this and deal with this is usually incredibly, incredibly nasty. It's terrifying to just read this code. I can't imagine writing it. And it's very architecture specific. Like, you know, the Intel ones were different from the ARM, which is very different from MIPS and so on. And even amongst, you know, the Intel earlier to later, there's many changes in between. So I didn't really feel auditing this code because I like my sanity. So I was like, okay, how about I just fuzz it? Well, and then so it comes down to, okay, well, how do you fuzz exceptions? And I'm like, well, I don't really know how to fuzz specific exceptions, but what if I just execute random instructions? Surely those things will hit some kind of exception. And when I say random instructions, I mean like super random. Like, I don't even know what the instructions are. Basically, what I do is I read from defurandom, and then I mmap page, I make a readable executable, fork off a process, basically set a function pointer to it, let that process do its thing. It will die. Usually, after instruction 2 or 3, the thing is dead. But you just keep doing that in a loop, in a loop, in a loop. And it generates all sorts of weird traps that the kernel now has to handle. And sure enough, if you do this on FreeBSD, you hit a couple of bugs. There's a Zen null ref, even though I wasn't using Zen. There's some send signal bug. There's all sorts of weird things that happen. So this is one of them. This is another one of them. And I could demo it, but I don't. The thing is, because it's so random, you never know when it hits. But essentially, this is all the code it takes. I mean, I have more advanced versions of this, but this is really all it takes to cause it. So if you just write something like this and you run it on the BSDs, and you know, it will hit kernel bugs. Anyway, that's it for trap handlers, and I'm happy with that because I don't want to talk more about trap handlers. So the next thing I was looking at are file systems. And so the attack surface in file systems, obviously the easy part of the attack surface is sort of the, you mount a USB stick or whatever, and then it has to parse the file system. And that's true. I believe, in my view, that's attack surface. But it turns out, in recent years, there's significantly new attack surface to file systems. And this comes in the form of Fuse. I don't know if you guys know what Fuse is. It's essentially user land file systems. And so what that means is all of a sudden, all these Unix VFS layers that have been around for many, many years that in previous years only took data from trusted drivers in kernel, where the data structures were, you know, more or less trusted, like the data in there you figured was more or less accurate because it was given to you by kernel. All of a sudden, all that data is handed to the VFS layer by a user land process, and the assumption that the data in there is trusted is no longer valid. And so if you start looking at the Fuse implementations for the BSDs, the first thing I thought was like, oh, well, it's Fuse, it's BSD. Sure, it's one implementation, and they all do the same thing. Well, it turns out that isn't true. It turns out all three BSDs wrote their entirely different Fuse implementations. There is no code share between all three of them. They're all entirely different. My view from looking at the code is that the NetBSD one is the most complete in terms of features. The FreeBSD one seems to be the one where arguments are the most controlled and constrained in terms of the amount of validation being done. And then the OpenBSD one is basically has the most minimal amount of implementation or features implemented compared to the other two. If you look at Fuse, it actually supports ioctl, but all three implementations of these do not implement ioctl. But they implement pretty much any other file system operation. Read, write, you know, read dir, get attributes, set attributes, that type of stuff. And so, for example, this is the OpenBSD get CWD system call, gets called by system call, and basically they'll do this thing where they go to the VFS layer and say get attribute, and then they fill out this VATR structure, and they assume everything in the VATR structure is more or less sane because it came from a kernel driver. But given that you now use Fuse, all data in VA is no longer trusted. It should be considered tainted, and you should validate it. And of course, they don't. And so they take this massive length value from it, and they pass it to malloc. And as I mentioned before, the OpenBSD malloc, when it sees a very large value, goes kernel panic. So this right here was a bug. And then if you look a little bit further in CWD, they'll do another call to the VFS layer, this VOP read dir, and basically, they get this this UIO structure back. Previously, when you did that kind of read there, again, it was file system data, but it was handed back from an in-kernel file system driver. So the structure was more or less trusted. And in this case, it's really just a buffer and a length. And so the content, because it now comes from a user land process, is no longer trusted. And so if you look at when it starts parsing the name length of an entry in a directory, it sort of just assumes that it's more or less valid. And then it uses that for a mem move, and that can cause an out-of-bound read. So basically, the problem with Fuse, and I would imagine you see this in Linux too, but I haven't looked yet, is that your VFS, if you implement something like Fuse, you have to modify your VFS layer because your VFS layer has all these assumptions where it assumes the data it gets from your file system is valid, and it's no longer true. So that was a sample of what OpenBSD, but the other BSDs had similar bugs. This particular bug, the bug was there since 2006, but I think Fuse is not quite that old, and so this has only recently been a real issue. And then obviously, if you look at the actual file system handler, when you give it a blob of data that you mount, so this is the X2 parser for FreeBSD. And this is, very briefly looked at this. I did not do an exhaustive search, but I was like, you know, grep for this thing called bread. And I'm like, oh, well, you're looking for some kind of string, and if the string isn't there, you just panic. Well, that's pretty bad. Basically, I can just give you a malicious X2 partition, and this thing will cause a panic. Obviously, the file system parsers in the BSDs are not what they should be. I suspect if you throw a simple file system fuzzer against these things, it'll blow up in all sorts of bizarre and weird ways. I literally just spent 5 minutes on this, and I was like, this is very, very broken. Because clearly, they're assuming valid file systems. Again, this bug's been there for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or so. But I suspect once you start hammering on the file systems, you'll find more bugs. Right. Networking beyond TCP/IP stack. I sort of mentioned BT, Wi-Fi, and IRTA, but I really only have Wi-Fi in my slides. The other two I kind of threw out because I didn't get to it. But when you look at the Wi-Fi attack surface, there are really two things you have to look at, right? One is the stack itself, and then one are the actual Wi-Fi drivers, right? And ideally, you want to have this thing where you have only one stack and then all the drivers sort of call into it, which is what the BSDs did. And Linux has this too. But in early days of Wi-Fi, sort of every driver came with its own full stack. But luckily, we're sort of past that, and there's one stack for all the drivers. The stack is sort of, it looks like the TCP/IP stack. I mean, it's obviously parses different protocols, but it's all in buffs, it's in and out, it's stuff that gets passed back and forth. The main input function is IEEE 802.11 underscore input, and once you start reading that, you sort of find the entire 802.11 parsing stack, and that function is called from all the Wi-Fi drivers. Sure enough, if you start reading that, eventually you find this function called IEEE 802.11 underscore epoll underscore key underscore input, and this basically deals with epoll keys. And it turns out, if you look at the structure for this thing, it actually has two different lengths. One is length and one is payload length. And this particular function does validate length and payload length, but then it has to do this thing called an mbuff pull-up. That is to say, it has to actually pull up enough continuous buffers to make sure there's that much length. And it does this for the payload length, but not for the other length field. And so turns out that the actual length field is used to actually read beyond the thing, to read the buffer. And so because the pull-up isn't done for the length, but for the payload length instead, if your length is bigger than your payload length, then you can end up having out-of-bound reads. And this can be triggered by remote Wi-Fi frames. Again, this comes back to mbuff mishandling. As I said previously in the TCP/IP stack part, mbuffs are hard. This wasn't OpenBSD 6.1 when I was auditing it, but it turns out the bug's been around for about 9 years. The drivers, the Wi-Fi drivers, this is the interesting part. The Wi-Fi drivers are either, Wi-Fi drivers in BSDs are either PCI or USB, right? So PCI is, when you put the card in and it basically has DMA access, but USB is different. USB is packet-based, right? And so it comes down to the question where it's like, do you trust your Wi-Fi radio, right? What if somebody compromises the Wi-Fi radio and then from there on tries to own your OS? For the PCI one, I was like, okay, well, if you're PCI, okay, it's kind of game over because they can do DMA. That's no longer true when you use things like the IOMMU, but let's just assume that if it's PCI and you handle it wrong, okay, fine. But when it comes down to the USB drivers for 802.11, the USB protocol is essentially packet-based, and so your USB host really should be able to, parse the packets correctly and not blow up if you get bizarre USB packets from your Wi-Fi radio. Turns out that they're currently not really doing that, and this leads to very, very trivial heap smashes. And I wanted to have one example, but I really gave you five examples of like the same thing. This is one driver where they go like, okay, there's a length field that can be up to a page long, and then we'll create an mbuff cluster which can be 2,000 bytes long, and then we'll just do a memcopy with that length into that cluster without ever validating if that length is bigger than a cluster. And obviously that means you get trivial memory corruption. And then this is a different Wi-Fi driver, and they say, okay, let's grab this linked field out of the USB packet, and then we'll basically use that and copy into an mbuf that can be up to 2,000 bytes. And again, very similar heap corruption bug. And then this is another driver, and it's a very similar thing with a memcopy with a linked, and then this is another driver, very similar thing, where they take a link, they do a memcopy, and it causes an mbuf heap corruption bug. And there's more of these, but those are the ones that were very trivial. So this is basically wide open attack surface across all BSDs, across various different, there's an Atmel, there's a Realtek, there's a whole bunch of these Wi-Fi drivers. this code is very trusting of the USB packets. It just assumes everything is done right. I think when these drivers were implemented, nobody thought about the attack surface on this one. So that's more or less it for the attack surface I had. There's a few more things I looked at and I kind of want to talk about. I didn't really have much detail about it, but so two things that I showed up that I sort of had seemed like there were many bugs in there. So one is there appeared to be a certain amount of easy detectable null DRFs in the BSDs. I spent some time looking at it in FreeBSD. I did a very quick rep on NetBSD, but I suspect there's a similar amount on NetBSD. Where basically, so the way you call malloc on the BSDs basically is you pass it a flag, and the flag is either basically says no wait, or I think the default behavior is that the malloc always waits, and when it succeeds, when it returns, it always succeeds; it never fails. But there's a way you can pass the flag, which is no wait or can fail. And what that means is if it can't fulfill the request within a certain amount of time, it returns and it fails the request, right? And so what you can do is you basically grep for these flags, and you see any time where there's a malloc done and a return value isn't checked, then you get a null DRF. And the reason these things show up is because by default, the pattern is malloc and not check return value, and you would think, okay, well, that's an easy pattern, and if you're writing kernel code, you would never make that kind of mistake, except because the general way malloc is called is where it could never fail, and so there's almost never a malloc kernel value check, except you have to do this when you're doing a no wait or can't fail. And it turns out there is, thank you, turns out there are quite a few cases where when you do malloc no wait or can't fail, people don't check return value. And so I think these are pretty greppable static analysis-wise, and I don't know why people haven't done this yet. But there's quite a few. So when I did grep on NetBSD, I think I had like 15 or 20. I can't remember how long the list was on FreeBSD. Another thing that was sort of interesting to see is that the BSDs have this direct rendering stuff in kernel, right? Direct rendering manager, direct rendering infrastructure. For those who don't know, these are basically the graphics drivers that are in kernel. And so when X11 runs, it sort of talks to these graphics drivers in kernel, and that the whole thing around it is called DRM or DRI. Because this sort of came from the open desktop people, and it was initially developed separate, and then a couple of years ago, it was moved into the Linux kernel. And then what the BSDs did is they kind of forked it, but it's essentially more or less the same code base. But the BSD guys kind of have to have it, otherwise X doesn't really do much anymore these days. It's interesting when you see the struggles they have with this. And if you look at the main OpenBSD developer who's responsible for maintaining DRM, DRI in OpenBSD, he said, all this Linux code that we are importing, it's not going to be reviewed by any of the OpenBSD kernel developers because they refuse to read any code that is not conforming to the BSD KNF standard. And so you have all of these rigorous code review standard practices on OpenBSD, except all this DRM, DRI stuff, they will not touch it. And so all the badness you see there in Linux kernel, all that stuff is pretty much in OpenBSD and NetBSD and FreeBSD as well. Okay, so that was sort of it for running through the types of bugs I was looking for and the things I found. I could have done another 2-3 hours running through a bunch of bugs, but it'd get pretty boring. What was my result? After I was done, about 3-ish months, I had about 115 bugs in total. 30 bucks in FreeBSD, about 25 bucks in OpenBSD, and the lion's share was in NetBSD. So about 60 or so in NetBSD. It was a very wide spectrum of bugs, pretty much everything you can, under the sun that you can expect, right? A straight up heap stack smashes, race conditions, expired pointers, double freeze, integer issues, underflows, overflows, sinus bugs, logic bugs. I had a typo somewhere where the wrong variable was used, but it turns out that one existed too, and then you had these weird things where the wrong thing was happening on the wrong structure because there was a typo. Division by zero, I had some logic bugs in there. I mean, pretty much anything you can imagine is in there. It turns out kernel code is not written by gods, and they too make mistakes. And they make plenty of mistakes, actually. So I found basically bugs amongst all three BSDs, amongst all of the attack surfaces I mentioned, and within that entire spectrum. But it's interesting, once I sort of got a grasp for all three of them and what was where and how it was done, it's interesting that I think I can make some observations about the code quality. And just looking at the bugs, like just the numbers of the bugs, right? You can see the same thing, right? And so there's sort of I think OpenBSD, when it comes to code quality in their kernel, is the clear winner, right? And it comes, the quote that I had from Theo originally where he says, oh, it's code quality, that's part of it. I think it became obvious to me that it's code quality, but also attack surface reduction. It's a combination of those two that seems to be a winning formula. And in OpenBSD, there is enormous attack surface reduction. If you compare it with the other BSDs, there are many things they do not have. They don't have loadable kernel modules. They have relatively few devices. They have virtually no compat code. They removed their Linux compat code a couple of years ago. They removed their entire Bluetooth stack because they thought the code sucked, and they just deleted it. So no Bluetooth support on OpenBSD. They have significantly less system calls. They have more than 200 system calls less than FreeBSD. And they cut support for a whole bunch of old architectures, right? And that, in combination with code quality, I think is a winning formula. The code quality is interesting because it really does show, if you look at the code, right, the trivial low-hanging fruit stuff is almost entirely gone in OpenBSD. Integer overflows, sinus bugs are virtually gone in OpenBSD. There's, like, the Wi-Fi driver stuff is something where I still found it because it was attack surface they never thought about. But anything that they know is attack surface, it's highly unlikely you find integer overflows there or sinus bugs, simply because they know about them. They inform their developers about what that looks like, and they have this every commit gets code reviewed by at least one or two people, and these people know exactly what these patterns look like. And it turns out when you have a process like that, integer overflows simply don't occur in attack surface. The other thing is that they had fewer info leaks than the other BSDs. In terms of the clear loser, that was OpenBSD. I think you can see that in these bugs. I mean, they have 60, the other two combined is less. So yeah, it was NetBSD. Tons of legacy code, tons of compat code. It turns out when you have legacy and compat code, when you have code that was written in 96 and you haven't looked at it since, you're gonna have bugs. They have these ISO protocols in there, which I don't know if anybody actually uses those these days. It's really ancient code from the 80s, which is written by IBM, and then it was imported in NetBSD, and it's been there ever since, and nobody knows what it does, but it's there. And a whole bunch of this really, really old code. The other thing is that their code seems to be less consistent with security code quality compared to the other BSDs. Unlike OpenBSD, they have tons and tons and tons of integer issues and sinus bugs. Just that one Akla show that, you know, 8 integer overflows right there. So there is definitely that sort of code quality difference. And I don't mean that as a diss. I mean, I understand that, I mean, building, maintaining, improving OS is really, really hard. And if you think it's easy, you know, try it. So I understand that it's very hard to do an OS. But there is a clear difference between, if you look at one and you look at the other, you can see there's a difference in code quality when you look at the attack surface. And then FreeBSD is somewhere in between, really. It's hard to place it, but it's not the code quality isn't as bad as NetBSD, but it's not as good as OpenBSD. So obviously when I found these bugs, I talked to the teams and I sent them emails and I said, hey, here's a list of bugs I have. You guys should probably go and find this, fix this. So I email the OpenBSD guys, and you know, Theo gets back to me. don't know, about a week or so later. And first thing he does, he says, oh, I'm sorry, it took me a week to get back to you. I was on vacation. And he says, oh, these bugs look good. This is definitely problematic. We should go and fix these things. And then he says, he emails me back and says, in the next 2 or 3 days, you should see fixes sort of coming in our CVS. And sure enough, the 25 or so bugs I reported, less than a week, and they fixed all of them, right? Yeah, I think that's good. And then a couple weeks later, the obesity guys basically made individual patches and advisories and said, okay, if you have an OpenBSD and you want to fix these bugs, here's the patches, here's how to do it. So I think that was great. I think that's perfect. I think that's the way it's supposed to be, right? Sort of the, you know, within a week response, a few days later, things are fixes. They have fixes in place, and then like a week or two after that, there's all the patches are publicly available. There's advisories. This is exactly the way a security process should work. OpenBSD guys have done everything right, as far as I'm concerned. So FreeBSD, how'd that go? Well, it sort of started off similarly, where I got a response within, I don't know, a couple of days, maybe a week. And I got a bug back from these guys and said, okay, well, we've seen all your bugs, and we filed them in our internal bug database. And this was July 14th, and sure enough, this is from the email. And I've blacked out what hasn't been fixed yet, or what I'm not quite sure of. There's three narratives that have been fixed, right? Since that email, not all that much has happened, right? It's 5 months later. Two advisories have been released. And so obviously those two bugs have been fixed. And then there's a third one, this ARC-E EDCAP. I saw a CVS commit for that. So I know that one's fixed. All the others, it's up in the air. I don't think they're fixed. I quickly checked CVS right before I came here. They look like they're still in limbo somewhere. This is where we're at with FreeBSD. Okay, NetBSD. First of all, when I emailed them these bugs, a list of 60 bugs, this shit got fixed overnight. seriously. This is obviously unbelievably impressive, right? I don't know how you can do that, but clearly there were two developers that were like, oh, let's fix this shit, let's fix it right now. So that was very impressive. And then as I mentioned, they also turned off the entire SGR4 compat subsystem. And if you look at the commit message, the email they sent me said basically, and this is mirrored in the commit message, they said, we've disabled the SGR4 by default, something that should have been done a long time ago. So that is incredibly impressive. That was late July 2017, 5 months ago. Let me tell you what's happened since. Absolutely nothing. Bugs are fixed in CVS. There are no patches for current. There are no advisories. What this effectively means is if you're running NetBSD today, all 60 bugs are there, and you can go to their CVS and see exactly what the bug is. So I wish they had followed up with some patches and advisories. So that kind of, it started off really, really, really well, and then they kind of dropped the ball. Okay, so coming back to my sort of, the earlier, where I began my presentation, the sort of the, okay, are things on equal footing? I think bugs are still very easy to find in the BSD kernels, probably about as easy as in the Linux kernel. Even OpenBSD wasn't, I mean, there were certain things I didn't see in OpenBSD, but it wasn't like it was hard to find bugs in there. There's varying level of quality between the two, between all three of them. It depends on the age and who wrote it and under what circumstances. The most consistent set of quality I found by far was OpenBSD. Again, this comes back to their rigorous review process, right? Every CVS check-in gets code reviewed. I think that's a process that simply just works. With the exception of the DRI, DRM stuff, the OpenBSD guys have the same shitty code everybody else has, and apparently the OpenBSD developers refuse to touch it. Another thing I have, or sort of think should happen, so because I had a couple of bugs where I was like, okay, this bug's in OpenBSD, but it was fixed in NetBSD, or any other thing around where I'm like, oh, this is NetBSD, but the OpenBSD guy fixed it 15 years ago, right? So those things from time to time did happen with some frequency. Ideally, I think the maintainers of the BSD should talk more amongst each other. Now understand that that's obviously easier said than done, because in the last 50 or 20 years they have diverged, and there's different philosophies and ideas on where the BSDs are supposed to go, and obviously, you know, there's big egos involved as well, and so getting these guys to talk isn't always very easy, and it doesn't always make sense. But by and large, I think there's enough commonality still between all the BSDs that it would make sense that when it comes to things that are attack surface and fixes, it would probably make sense if these guys talked more with each other. The other thing is that obviously when it comes to things, you know, if you look at code base alone, that tells you something about the attack surface, right? OpenBSD's kernel is about 2.8 million lines of code. NetBSD is about 7.3 million, and NetBSD's, and this is 10, this was 11.0, I don't know what the latest one is. The FreeBSD was about 9 million, right? So that alone right there tells you that OpenBSD's can have less bugs because they have less code, right? It's that easy. So obviously this plays a part, right? You can't have a bug in code that you don't have, right? And the other thing is obviously sort of accidental versus planned, where if I haven't implemented something yet, then you can't have it yet, right? But the other thing is obviously is that the plan, where the choice is to make to delete code on purpose, and this is something you clearly saw in OpenBSD, where you know they chose to delete their Bluetooth stack, they chose to delete their Linux compat layer, and obviously it's a double-edged sword, right? You lose functionality, but you gain security, and you try to find that balance. But obviously, you know, cutting code, you know, that generally gives, you know, it cuts stack surface and generally means you have less bugs. More conclusions. Basically, going back to what I, original thing I had, which was the mini eyeballs thing, I think that's a factor. I think it really does matter, right? I think if you have more people looking at something, more bugs are going to be found. And so I think one of the big reasons why the numbers are off when you compare those tables initially, I think a large part of it is, you know, more people are looking at the Linux kernel, and so they're going to find more bugs. Code quality can't explain everything. You can say what you want about the people writing Linux kernel, but, you know, there are just orders of magnitude people, more people looking at that code. They're just going to find more bugs. And it shows in the numbers. And that's pretty much it.
That was frightfully awesome.
That was pretty much it. There were no other tools involved.
Thanks.
I think we'll take one more, huh? One more?
Sure, yeah.
One more here? Didn't you want to? Now's your big chance.
Could you describe your motivation of spending 3 months on that work?
I know code review isn't for everyone. I think I once heard it described being, you know, more boring than watching paint dry. I disagree with that. I enjoy writing reading code. I think it's fun. I think there's a number of things you can learn from reading code. And you get the sort of interesting sort of kick from it, right? Like, if I find a bug in piece of, like, sometimes you use a piece of code and you're like, oh, they screwed this up. Like, I noticed this and they didn't. So there's a little bit of that. But generally, I generally enjoy it, and I know some people don't. But for me, it wasn't a depth march. It wasn't a stretch. I had no problem. And when I say three, four months, I mean on and off, because obviously I have work and things. So it's like evenings and weekends. But it wasn't hard. It wasn't difficult. I was just like, okay, let's open up my laptop, and I'll spend the next 3 or 4 hours looking at, you know, the system call or something. I didn't think it was hard. I understand that it's not for everyone, but I tend to enjoy code review.
Thanks again for your work.
Awesome.
Okay, thank you very much. Am I overseeing a question somewhere? No? Now's your chance. The internet.
Yes, there's one final question from the internet. While the BSDs may not be cooperating, is there at least a common mission statement or any high-level thing they could at least agree on?
This is a non-security BSDs question. I have no idea.
You're the winner. Okay. Das Zentrum für politische Schönheit ist ein Zusammenschluss von rund 70 Aktionskünstlern und es besticht durch Kunst, die wehtut, die schmerzt, die Provokation setzt und die auf Widerstand geht. Gegründet und geleitet vom Chefunterhändler Philipp auf der Innenseite von der Bühne, der mit seinen radikalen Aktionen zum wohl bekanntesten deutschen Politikkünstler wurde. Mit auf der Bühne auch noch auf der Außenseite CEO Stefan, CEO eher zu verstehen als Chief Escalation Officer. Und die beiden geben uns heute mit Tiger, Drucker und ein Mahnmal einen Blick zurück auf die letzten 3 Jahre seit ihrem letzten Besuch hier am Kongress. Und nun, Bühne frei für die beiden Aktionskünstler.
Ganz, ganz wichtig für mich. Jetzt haben wir einen Haufen Applaus schon als Vorschusslorbeeren bekommen, aber hier im Saal sitzen so viele Leute, die uns in irgendeiner Art und Weise geholfen haben, die entweder direkt mit dem Team sind, die in Bornhagen beim Höcke die Dinger gebaut haben, die uns am Computer geholfen haben und so weiter. Und jetzt bitte nochmal mindestens genauso viel Applaus für die ganzen Leute, die hier sitzen und uns so krass unterstützen.
Willkommen auf unserer alldreijährlichen Bundeserpressungskonferenz hier auf dem CCC-Kongress. Wir freuen uns außerordentlich, wieder hier zu sein und wollen für die Einladung dem Chaos Computer Club ganz, ganz herzlich danken und allen Helfern, die hier diesen fantastischen Kongress